allowed Kuan to be led away to the stables beyond the gardens. "You have many slaves," he said to Paulus as they walked inside.
"Not slaves, helpers, servants if you like."
He led the once knight to a suite of rooms and gave him his first goblet of Ambria. As he drank it, Menannan felt strength surge through his limbs.
"What is it?"
he asked, astonished.
"It is the bedrock of our civilization. It is life, Menannan. Drink of this and you will never have need of medicine. Neither will you age."
Samuel Danach and the other knights were away in the north, he was told, but they would return in about a month. At first, Menannan was concerned and restless. Could he not ride out to meet them? Paulus agreed that he could, but advised him to rest for a few days, gather his strength, and then he would supply a guide. But the days passed, and Menannan grew to love the white-towered city. There was something about it that opened his soul. The problems of the realm seemed so far away, and the world he had left behind so remote and petty. He bathed in scented water, and found no need of food. One drink, and his strength returned in seconds. The people here were gentle, and he spent several days roaming the libraries and museums, studying the customs of the Vairi. They were not a warrior race, though once, according to the histories, they had boasted great armies. Now they employed a mercenary force to patrol their borders, but there was little trouble with neighboring lands.
"Where is Samuel Danach?"
he asked Paulus on the fourth day of his stay.
"He is helping to rescue some people from your own troubled land. Nomads, I believe they are called. He has opened a gate for them to allow them to settle in our land."
"That is kind of you."
"It is not just kindness, Menannan. We have suffered terrible plagues here during the last 30 years, and there are few people left to till the earth or supply our needs. The land needs new blood. There are some 2,000 nomads settled already in the north. Perhaps when Samuel Danach returns, you can visit the new towns they're building."
On the fifth day, Menannan had been ill at ease. He felt strong as a lion, but on edge. He spoke of his feeling to Paulus, who smiled and clapped him on the shoulder.
"You must understand," said the Magister, "that the Ambria is working inside you, rebuilding your body, making it stronger than it has ever been. It is also making you more aware of your body. What you need is a companion for your bed."
"I am pledged to celibacy," Menannan had told him.
"Truly? For what purpose? Man was intended to mate. Trust me, Menannan."
He had sent Drea to him that night, and she was divine to look at as well as being bright, witty, and charming. Together they had finished a pitcher of Ambria and made love throughout the night. And Paulus was right. The tension in Menannan was gone. He felt smooth and relaxed, at one with this new world. After Drea, he had enjoyed Senlis, Marin, and others whose names he could not now remember. The joy of it all was almost too hard to bear. The city of the Vairi was close to Menannan's view of paradise. It had everything except an all-powerful god, and truth be told, that made it somehow even better than paradise. There were no judges here. The only lure seemed to be joy. And the days passed. Menannan read the books of the Vairi, learned their poetry, viewed their painting and sculpture, made love to their women. The once knight was content for the first time in his life. Soon Samuel Danach would return, and they would ride to the rescue of Olothair, put the realm to rights, and then return here to enjoy the rewards of the blessed. On the 16th evening, Menannan fell asleep with these dreams in his mind. He awoke in the middle of the night, shivering and cold, and reached for his Ambria only to find the pitcher empty. He swore and rose. He was sure it had been half full when he fell asleep, but Paulus would have more. As he stood, he saw a figure sitting in the chair by the window, her back to the moonlight, her face in shadow.
"Who are you?"
he asked. "Never mind, just let me get a drink and I will talk to you."
"You need a drink to be able to talk," she responded,
her voice low and deep. Something stirred in Manannan's memory, but it danced like morning mist, dispersing as he reached for it. "No, of course not, but I am cold." He moved towards the door.
"Then put a blanket around your shoulders. You look foolish standing there naked, holding that picture."
"Who are you?"
"I'm a friend, Manannan. The only friend you have here."
"Nonsense. I have made more friends here than in all my life."
"Come," she said, "sit and talk."
"I need a drink."
"There is fresh water," she offered.
"I don't need water," he snapped.
"No," she admitted, "you need Ambria. You need the nectar of the gods. Is it too late for you, Manannan?"
"Do not speak in riddles, woman. I have no time for this. I did not ask you here."
"You did not.
Nor did I ask to be here in this cursed city. But such is the game of life.
You are a knight of the Kabbalah, and once that meant something to the world. Only the strongest, the noblest could dream of donning the silver armor. Are you strong, Manannan?"
"I have never been stronger."
"Then let me set you a task. Not a difficult task. Sit here with me until the dawn. Do not leave this room until the sun rises. Is that too difficult, Sir Knight?"
"What a ridiculous question. Of course it would not be difficult. But I have no wish to play this game. Now leave me in peace."
"The call of the Ambria is strong, is it not?"
"I know. I cannot resist it. For me it has been too long, and no one warned me of its terrible properties." Manannan hurled the pitcher aside. "Damn you, woman! Does your prattle never end?"
He stormed across to her and dragged her to her feet.
It was then that she turned towards him, and the moonlight fell upon her face. Manannan recoiled as if struck.
"Morrigan! Dear gods! Morrigan?"
"I am grateful that you remember me."
"How did you come here?"
"Samuel Danak brought me, 10 days after you. They passed the Black Gate. He came to me in the night, took me in his arms and told me he loved me. He said he would show me paradise." She laughed grimly. "Instead, we came here."
"But this is not an evil place."
"Because they are cultured and have treated you well. They have done a terrible thing to you, Manannan."
"Not so. I'm strong, and I'm happy. What terrible thing is that?"
"And why did you come?"
"To find Samuel Danach."
"In order to return home?"
"Yes. To combat the evil in the realm caused by the king and his red knights."
"Yes." Morrigan sat down and stared out over the moonlit garden, silent for a while. Then she looked up at Manannan.
"The red knights are led by Samuel Danach. They are your friends, my dear. They are the knights of the Kabbalah."
"I do not believe it. Paulus says they are in the north, resettling nomads."
"Indeed they are, or they were.
But you have not heard it all yet, Manannan. The nomads are coming here in their thousands, but not to till the land. They are the Ambria. They are the food for the Vairi. That is what we are here, drinkers of souls. That is immortality, Manannan. We suck the essence of life itself from other human beings. We're not immortal. We are merely undead."
That is the drink you lust after. If you still want it, go and find it.
You are lying. It cannot be as you say. It cannot.
I want you to try to remember the man you were when you rode here. The dreams that you had. Think back to all you held dear. Think of me as I once was. You have been corrupted, even as Samuldanach and the others were corrupted. Great men, noble men, who now spend their days gathering human souls for Paulus and the Vairi. Look at me, Mananan.
Suddenly she rose, gripped him by the shoulders and bared her teeth. As he watched, her incisors lengthened into fangs, pointed and hollow. He thrust her from him.
Can you not see?
She screamed. Get away from me! You are a demon! You are not Morrigan at all! Be gone!
It is too late for you, Mananan,
she whispered as she moved past him to the door.
I am so sorry.
Wait, he called, as she moved into the doorway. Please, Morrigan. She turned. He was sweating now and beginning to feel nauseous. Taking a deep breath, he walked back to the window, sitting down on the sill and breathing deeply of the scented air. She came back into the room, pushing the door closed behind him.
I cannot believe you, he said softly. But I will listen, and I will accept your challenge to sit out the night.
She nodded and sat facing him in the moonlight. Her face was pale, and there were silver streaks in her long golden hair. But her eyes were, as he remembered, large, dark, and almost slanted.
Samuldanach brought me through the Black Gate. Everywhere there were monsters, demons, but he held them at bay with his silver sword, and we rode for the city. I could not believe its beauty, and was astonished at the greeting we received. Paulus and several others opened up their homes to the knights. They fed us ambria, and we were happy. Never before or since have I tasted such happiness. And we changed, Mananan, even as you were changing. I tried to stop drinking the ambria, but I could not. It fastens to the soul, corrupting, distorting. New realities appeared. And we learnt that the Vairi were dying, their food sources disappearing. Soon there would be no ambria.
Mananan leaned forward. How did this happen? Are there not people in this land? She smiled.
The half pitcher you had when I came here would have cost maybe 50 lives. This is a large city, Mananan. To feed it would take a nation of, shall we say, lesser beings. Hence the nomads. Samuldanach and the others returned to the realm, taking with them ambria for the king. They had new armor then. The magical garb of the Elder Vairi. The warrior race who first conquered this land. They were greeted well, and the king took them to his council. But the ambria ran out, and the king learned, as did Samuldanach, how to draw life from living victims.
That is what is so hard to believe, said Mananan. He was always the most noble of men. He clutched his stomach and groaned. Where did you put the ambria? I just need a mouthful. I will be fine then.
Wait. Be strong. You will see. Breathe deeply, Mananan.
I cannot. The smell from the garden is too sickly.
That is what I'm saying. The ambria shifts perceptions. Look around at the room.
He did as she bade him. The white walls seemed greyer now, and he noticed mould above the window. The silken sheets on the bed were filthy and soiled, and the room smelt of decay. He turned back to Morrigan to see that her pale ivory skin was dry, her eyes dull, her lips tinged with blue. He swallowed hard.
But is this real? I don't know any more. It is real, she whispered. You are living in the city of the undead. You are in hell, Manannan. Samuel Danach almost saw it, but the Ambria took him.
Manannan looked out into the garden where the rockery steps were choked with weeds. He staggered to his feet.
Is there any water?
Yes, she said, fetching him a pitcher from the outer room. But be careful. It will not taste good to you, for the Ambria is jealous.
He drank deeply and choked.
Have some more, she urged him. It will do you good.
His stomach rebelled, but he forced down the water. We must get out, he said. Back to the gate.
I wouldn't know how to open it, she told him. But Paulus would.
He groaned again.
What is happening to me? There is such pain. You were becoming one of us. Now your body, your life is fighting back.
His head dropped and he rubbed at his eyes.
Why are you doing this for me? How is it that you are not affected by the Ambria?
She laughed and rose.
Not affected, Manannan? Oh, but I am. I drank your half-pitcher. When I look around this room, I see only beauty and a man I desire. But I can remember how I felt when first I came here, when Samuel Danach was a god to me. I cling to that memory, and I do not want to see you, my oldest and dearest friend, riding out to gather souls for the Vairi.
Help me to dress. He looked around, searching the room. Where is my armor?
You will need no armor where you are going, said Paulus from the doorway.
Beyond him were several warriors in black armor, helms down, swords in their hands.
We offered you immortality, Manannan. Now you will merely aid our own.
The warriors surged forward to pin the arms of the once knight. Paulus shook his head.
Such a pity. I thought you were strong, like your brothers. But no. Even a fallen woman can turn your head from the glories of what could have been for you. Your stupidity offends me. Take him away.
Chapter 14. Nuada was surprised when the Dagda summoned him, following the poet's evening performance in the hall. The old man had been allocated quarters, close to the hut Nuada shared with the girl Katia, and a sentry had come to them just before midnight.
I don't think you should go, Katia told Nuada, taking him by the arm. He is a demonic man, and the Lord Groundsel says he never gives good news.
Nuada shrugged.
I have met very few genuine seers. I cannot pass this by. But I will ask him no questions of death. Do not fear for me, Katia.
He smiled at her and kissed her cheek.
I will return soon.
He walked out into the cold night air and glanced up at the shining stars. Shivering in the chill, he drew his cloak about him. The sentry pointed to an open doorway through which he could see the amber glow of a brazier. He stepped inside to see the Dagda, sitting cross-legged on a goatskin rug, his eyes closed and his hands spread. Nuada cleared his throat and tapped on the doorframe.
Enter, poet. Be at ease, said the Dagda, opening his eyes, and Nuada pushed the door closed.
There were no chairs nor furniture of any kind, so he sat on the rug next to the old man.
Is there anything you would ask me?
Queried the Dagda. Nuada grinned.
Nothing, sir. I have no wish to learn the day of my death.
Then why did you obey my summons? The Dagda asked, his dark eyes fixing Nuada with a piercing gaze.
To learn of you, sir. I would guess there is a song in your travels, and I would be delighted to sing it.
Some matters are not suited to song, my boy, and some lives are better left to mystery and magic.
But you intrigue me.
Are you aware of the colors?
Of course, Nuada replied, though I have no special skill with them. Why do you ask?
The old man stroked his forked white beard, then rose and added wood to the fire in the brazier. Nuada watched him closely. He seemed older than time, yet his movements were smooth, almost liquid. His hands were slender, yet strong, and there were no liver spots upon their backs.
"The colors," said the Dagda, returning to sit before the poet,
"are created of harmony. We all add or subtract to and from the colors. Even as we talk, the red is growing stronger over the realm of the Gabala. Everywhere, the more vile of emotions predominate. Lust, greed, selfishness rule in Firbolg. Of care and compassion there is little to be seen. How strange, then, that in this forest peopled by evil men, the red should hold little sway. What answer can you offer for this?"
"I have no answers," Nuada told him. "I am a saga poet. I merely retell stories."
"Can you see colors in men?" asked the Dagda suddenly. "Can you look into a man's eyes and know his soul?"
"No, I take it you can."
The Dagda grinned. "Yes, I can. It is both a curse and a gift. I was here last year, in this pit of a settlement. The red was everywhere. Now it has vanished, and the white holds sway here now. Only just, mind. Do you know why?"
"You keep asking me the same question. I can answer it no other way."
"You are the answer, poet. I watched you tonight, filling their heads with nobility and strength. None more so than the sewer rat groundsel. You are the stone that falls into the center of the lake, sending ripples out into the farthest corners. Now that is a gift worth having."
"You are beginning to lose me," said Nuada. "Are you saying my stories change men's hearts?"
"I cannot believe that. I accept that I can, for a short time, suspend their disbelief. But in the morning, when they wake, I am just a part of the previous night's entertainment."
"Not so, Nuada. A man is a complex beast, and his soul is like a sponge, drawing in emotions in a random manner. Strike him, and he becomes angry, his soul red as blood. Feed him, stroke him, make love to him, and his soul softens, blurs, changes. You fill them with glory, make them all believe they can be better, stronger. You force them to draw in the power of the white."
Nuada thought for a moment. "Is that bad? Is it wrong?"
"Not at all. It is close to holiness. A man is what he knows, but his soul will yearn for all that he does not know, for hidden there is all he may become."
"I take it, sir," said Nuada uneasily, "that there is a point to this conversation, and you have yet to make it."
"There is, and I have."
"You have many choices, Nuada."
"I cannot tell you that which you fear. I do not know. It happens with perhaps one man in a thousand. You could live for 50 more years, or you could die in a few days. All depends on the choices you make. But you are a man of power, and this will mean you will draw evil to you. It cannot be avoided. The king is insane. He has summoned his army and is determined to enter this forest and destroy all who live here."
"Why? There's nothing here. No wealth, no army, and surely no threat."
"There is a threat here. It is you. As we speak, the king sits in Maktha with his advisers. They turn their eyes to the forest of the ocean, and they see the power of the white and the green. The red is beaten back, their color, their strength. They cannot tolerate it. They wonder, as wonder they must, how long it will be before the white pushes back."
"Are you saying the king and his knights are right to fear, poet? That is madness."
Did I not say he was insane? All evil men are insane, Nuada. The question is, and here is the point, what will you do?
Do? What is there for me to do? I will tell my stories and move on. In the spring I shall be in Citheron.
The Dagda nodded.
That is a good choice. You will live long and happily there and breed fine sons.
Well, that's good to know. But I see by your eyes you are disappointed.
Not at all, replied the Dagda sharply. There is nothing in the world of men to surprise or disappoint. When you go, the white will wither and the red will gain sway. Many will die, and die horribly. The forest will become a charnel house. And if I stay, all will be peace and harmony. I think not, Dagda.
You are correct. But there will at least be balance in the contest, and the white could win with your help.
Do I still live for 50 years and breed fine sons?
The Dagda was silent, and Nuada chuckled without humour.
I thought not. It is not fair of you to put this pressure upon me. I have done nothing to harm you.
On the contrary, young man, you have done much to please me. It was not entirely true to say that there is nothing in the world to surprise me. I wander this forest and I see the brutality, the cruelty of man. It is more than pleasant to see Groundsel behave like a hero, to see him care for a golden-haired child. You have been good for him. He will die well for you. I do not want anyone to die for me, least of all Groundsel. Gods, I even like the little man.
And why not?
Offered the Dagda. There is now much to like.
Are you advising me to stay? Are you telling me it is my duty to stand against the king and his red knights?
It is not for me to instruct you in the ways of duty, Nuada. You are a man. A good man. I am here to tell you the choices you face. No more than that. I will not judge you if you decide to make a life in Citheron.
No, you have merely made sure that I will judge myself.
Do not play with words, old man. Tell me what can be done to aid the white.
The knights of the Gabala must ride again.
No one knows where they are.
They are with the king, said the Dagda. They are his red slayers, his drinkers of souls. They are vampires, Nuada.
Then how can they ride again on the side of the white?
They cannot. They are corrupted by the evil they sought to destroy.
Spare me the riddles, then, stormed Nuada. How can the knights ride again?
There must be new knights to restore the balance. Even more than this, they must reflect the old knights. We had 8 good men who turned to evil. You must help to find 8 men who can become good. Seek out a man called Ruad Rufessa. He is the armorer. He will advise.
Where shall I find him? And how many knights are there in this forest?
There is one lord here. You gave him the title yourself.
Groundsel? Do you think Groundsel would become a knight of the Gabala?
He can be the first, Nuada. The first of your knights of dark renown.
Ruad was walking alone in the high meadows when Lamfada came up to him. The youth stood back for a while, waiting for Ruad to acknowledge him. The craftsman cleared snow from a boulder and sat, removing his bronze eye patch and rubbing at the withered skin of the socket beneath.
It itches badly, boy, he said, gesturing Lamfada forward.
He forced a smile.
What troubles you, lad? When I woke this morning, old Gwydion seemed ill at ease. Was it something you said?
Lamfada nodded.
I have been awake most of the night.
Gwydion told me I had a nightmare. But I believe I have found my colour. It is gold, Ruad. It is all the colours woven together.
Tell me of it,
said the wizard gravely. Lamfada explained about his first flight as a child, when he'd seen the knights ride through the Black Gate, and had destroyed the wolf creature with a blast of golden lightning. Then he spoke of soaring over the forest of the ocean on a disk of gold and scattering the wolf pack, and reviving the stag. But he could not yet bring himself to talk of the knight, Peteus. Ruad listened in silence, until the youth had finished his story.
I knew you had power, my boy. I could sense it in you. And I still recall how the falling feathers of your bird reversed their flight. The talent was buried deep within you. It still is. But it will surface again, and next time it will be stronger. Bear with it. Such power is not granted without reason. You will have need of it.
Lamfada stood and looked away.
I'm not wise, Ruad. I do not know whether to speak. When I told Gwydion of my flight and what happened, he grew upset and urged me not to tell you. But I think he was wrong. I hope you will not be angry. But I left something out of my tale.
And slowly, falteringly, Lamfada explained about the Red Knight, watching with growing apprehension as the colour faded from Ruad's face.
Peteus, he said his name was Peteus.
Yes, sir. Cabra Peteus. Who is he?
He is a knight of the Gabala, the eldest of my knights. He is the sin of pride returned to haunt me.
Ruad saw the fear in Lamfada's face.
No, no, boy, do not be frightened. You were right, and Gwydion was wrong. Very wrong. Some time ago, before I came to this forest, I saw a vision of 8 red knights. Deep down I knew who they were, and I knew who led them. But I would not face my fears.
What happened to them?
Asked Lamfada, returning to sit beside the craftsman.
They lost. Simply that. They found evil, and it conquered them.
How could that be? They were the greatest of knights.
I have no answers, save that evil rarely stalks the land with horns and fire. If it did so, all men would turn from it. Take me, Lamfada. I sent 9 good men into an unknown realm, filled with terrible dangers. Was that a good deed? I did it not for the world, but for my own glory. I tell myself it was not evil, but great evil has come from it. Do you wish to debate that with me?
I am no debater, sir, but I see no evil in you.
No. But then had you known Sameldanach, or Peteus, or Mananan, you would have said the same.
What can you do, Ruad? Are they as strong as before?
If Peteus can now fly the colours, he is stronger than ever he was. And only the source knows how powerful Sameldanach has become. I need to think, Lamfada. Best that you leave me for a while.
The youth stood for a moment, wishing he could say something, do something to help the man who had befriended him. But there was nothing, and he turned sadly away. At the bottom of the hill he found Elladan hurling stones at a target chalked on a tree. None of the missiles came close to the target, and his throwing stance was disjointed and awkward.
A pox on it! Snapped Elladan.
Then he saw Lamfada and grinned.
Never give up, boy. That's the answer. It's what separates men from the beasts of the herd. The problem is threefold, you see. A man is right-sided or left-sided. Eye, hand and leg. I'm trying to change the focus of my being, to become left-sided, if you will.
Is that possible?
I doubt it. But I will continue my efforts until my dying day. I can do no more. I will not sit in some hut until my hair turns silver, dreaming of what once I was. Come, Let us find some food.
He glanced at Lamfada.
What is wrong, boy?
The youth told him of his conversation with Ruad, and Elladan sighed.
That is grim news. I knew Samaldanach. What a swordsman. It is hard to believe.
Ruad says evil is not always ugly, but I'm not sure I understand what he means.
I'll explain it to you, but first we'll eat, said Elladan as they returned to the cabin,
where the three golden hounds sat like statues. Gwydion was absent when they arrived, and they prepared a meal of cold meat and cheese, washed down with cool spring water. Then Elladan stoked up the fire and sat facing the blond youth.
A long time ago, when I was young, I saw a woman who fired my blood. I met her in the King's Park. She and her servants used to gather flowers there. She was beautiful. But she was married to a nobleman twice her age and very unhappy. We met by chance and then by design. I fell in love with her. Hopelessly, completely. I dreamed of taking her away to my estates in the north, raising a family. But it could not be. Not while her husband lived. I grew to hate him. Though there was nothing to hate. By his lights he was a good man. But I would fall asleep at night dreaming of his death. It could not be right, I decided, that someone so young and beautiful should be saddled with such a husband. Anyway, one day I told a friend of mine to whisper my name to the man, and to tell him I was seeing his wife in secret. The husband had no choice then but to challenge me to single combat. He was old, but still canny. But his years betrayed him, and I slew him. And that was an evil deed.
Lamfada swallowed hard.
But what of the woman?
She inherited his wealth and married her lover. I was merely the instrument of her freedom. But I believed I was doing right. I'd convinced myself he was evil and cruel. Self-deception, Lamfada. That is why I stood for Kester against the king. Her husband was Kester's son. You understand now something of what Ruad meant?
I'm not sure. There are stories of terrible deeds in Firbolg, of nomad families being massacred. How can the men responsible not see that as evil? It is not the same as being in love with a beautiful woman and fighting a duel.
Elladan shrugged.
We were talking of self-deception. Samaldanach loved the realm the way most men love a woman. If he came to believe that the nomads were responsible for the nation's fall from power, I would guess he could come to hate them. But I cannot answer for him.
They believe Hlorgivus has an army and they are coming here in the spring. I think it will be terrible when they arrive.
Elladan nodded and gazed down at the stump at his wrist.
Even were I not crippled, I could not stand against the Gabala knights. Kevra took me as simply as I took the husband. Damn Hlorgivus!
Elladan pushed himself to his feet.
I need to return to my work. I will see you later.
Lamfada watched him go, then cleared away the plates and cleaned them behind the cabin. Glancing up, he saw a stag in the distance. Suddenly its head came up and it sprinted for cover. Lamfada scanned the countryside looking for sign of wolves, and saw the 500 black-cloaked riders silhouetted against the skyline. As the riders thundered across the half-mile of snow-covered meadows, Lamfada raced back into the village shouting at the top of his voice. People streamed from the huts, saw the raiders and began to run for the shelter of the trees. Elladan gathered up a hatchet and joined Lamfada.
Get to Ruad. He must not be taken, said the crippled warrior.
What will you do?
I'll stay with the stragglers.
Some of the men had armed themselves with bows and knives, and Elladan bellowed at them to make for the trees.
Stay together and form a line at the top of the hill.
There were 14 bowmen in the party, including Brion, the husband of Umpta.
"Why are they attacking us?" Brienne asked as they ran. "There's nothing here for them."
"Ask them when they get here,"
snapped Elladan. The raiders, swords drawn, galloped into the village. An old man, slower than the other refugees, was the first to be caught as a lance took him high in the back, lifting him from his feet. For a second or so his legs flapped in the air, then the lance snapped, and he tumbled to the ground beneath the pounding hooves. A child ran from a cabin, screaming with fear. Her mother, on the hillside above, turned and sprinted back for her. The child was trampled to death, the mother speared. Then the soldiers were clear of the cabins and heading for the hillside. Elladan formed the bowmen into a line.
"Ignore the riders. Aim for the horses and bring them down. It's the only way to stop the charge. And do not loose the shafts until I order it."
Longbows were hastily strung and arrows notched to the strings.
"Draw!"
bellowed Elladan. The riders were slowing now as the hill took its toll on their mounts, but still they were closing fast. At 40 paces, Elladan's raised arm swept down.
"Now!"
he shouted. The arrows hammered home at the center of the line and horses reared and fell. But the wings of the charging line continued forward, sweeping round towards the bowmen.
"Left!"
ordered Elladan. The bowmen smoothly notched more shafts and loosed them. Horses tumbled to the snow, hurling their riders to the ground.
"Now to the right!"
The horsemen were almost upon them, and two of the bowmen broke and ran for the trees. Elladan ignored them as the remaining archers bent their bows and loosed their shafts at point-blank range.
"Now run!"
shouted Elladan, turning and sprinting towards the trees. He heard a horse close behind him and turned to see a lancer bent low over the saddle, his weapon aimed at Elladan's heart. The crippled warrior drew back his arm and flung the hatchet with all his might. It sailed over the horse's head to bury itself in the rider's face, and he tumbled back from the saddle. One of the archers was down, hacked to death. The others were racing for the trees. Elladan cursed. They would never make it. Suddenly a score of arrows flashed from the undergrowth, ripping into the riders. Then again, and again, the soldiers turned and fled down the hillside. Clog Givis stepped out to stand beside Elladan.
"You are a man of iron," said Clog. "That must be a compliment, coming from a blacksmith." "It is. I sweated blood when I saw you form that fighting line. They'll be back, Clog, and we do not have the men to hold them, but I'm glad you came when you did." "A man needs some luck," said Clog. "I came upon a hunting party from this village, and they said you were here, so I came with them. Then we heard the screaming and took up positions in the bushes."
"So," whispered Elladan, "the great hero, Stronghand, was seeking me. Might I inquire why?"
"I need a man who understands the ways of war."
"Then you are to gather an army.
It's about time, Clog. Well, this cripple will help you, if you'll have him."
Clog clapped him hard on the shoulder.
"That hatchet throw was a good one. I'd say you were coming on."
"I was aiming for the horse," snapped Elladan. "I missed it, at less than 10 feet.
"I'll not tell a soul," Clog promised. "Now let's get back. Brienne is heading the villagers for the long caves, but we'll need food and firewood."
"Might I suggest something?"
Clog grinned.
"You are our general.
Leave me 20 men and I will form a rear guard while you move on."
"Be careful, Elladan. I don't want to lose you this early in the fight."
"They've made it a war, my friend. Now they must learn what that means."
Bavis Lan, the leader of the raiders, dismounted before the cabin where sat the 3 golden hounds. He walked under the rough-hewn porch and knelt by the statues.
"By Chera, they're gold," he whispered.
His aide, Lugus, joined him and stood by silently as Bavis examined the statues.
Well, snapped the leader, don't just stand there, Lugus. Make your report.
Lugus saluted crisply.
We lost 18 horses and 9 men dead. 8 other men have injuries. Shall we pursue them into the trees?
Bavis stood, a tall, lean man in his middle 40s. He removed his helm and ran a hand through his silver-streaked hair.
No. Once inside the tree line, they would pick us off with ease. We hit 2 settlements today, and we've given them something to think about. We'll camp here and strike north along the valley tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
What do you make of these statues?
They're beautiful, sir.
Aren't they just? I shall take them back to Maktha as a present for the king.
The cabin door opened and a thick-set man appeared. Bavis turned, his hand reaching for his sword. The man was powerfully built and sported an eye patch of bronze. Behind him stood a blond youth, his eyes fearful.
Who the devil are you?
Bavis asked.
The owner of the hounds. I fear they are too precious to put before a dullard like Ahak. He would not appreciate them. They have no blood, you see. Your conversation brands you a traitor, snarled Lugus, dragging his sword clear.
And your deeds brand you a butcher,
responded the man, dropping his hand to touch the head of the nearest hound.
Ollifer, he said.
The hound's jeweled eyes snapped open, and as Lugus's sword came up it leapt, sinking its teeth into the officer's forearm. Before he could even scream, the hound's jaws snapped shut, and the arm and hand were torn clear. Lugus sank to his knees, staring in horror at the blood seeping from the stump at the end of his arm. The general was frozen to the spot. The man with the eye patch stepped back into the cabin, the 3 hounds following him. The door closed. A flash of gold light streamed from the open window. Bavis Lan blinked and then ran forward, kicking the door from its hinges. The cabin was empty.
Help me,
pleaded Lugus.
Dear gods, help me. Surgeon,
bellowed Bavis.
Someone find the surgeon.
High on the hillside, the air split with a flash of light and Ruad stepped clear, followed by Lamfada and the hounds. The sorcerer's face was grim, and his hands were shaking. He turned and dragged the blood-drenched arm from the jaws of the hound and hurled it out onto the hill.
A curse on them all, he hissed.
We should find the others, said Lamfada softly, unable to tear his eyes from the dismembered limb on the snow.
Ruad did not hear him. He stared down at the village, watching the soldiers running to aid the crippled officer.
I will make you pay for this, Ahak, he swore. Somehow, Ollifer will make you pay.
He turned away and walked swiftly into the trees, the hounds padding alongside. They reached the long caves at dusk and found Gwydion tending an injured man. Fires had been lit inside the caves, and the refugees were gathered round them. Clor Givers approached the one-eyed sorcerer.
Are you the craftsman?
I am, said Ruad.
He looked closely at the broad-shouldered blonde warrior, noting the pale blue eyes and the red-gold beard.
And you a strong hand. I hope the name fits you, boy. You'll have need of your strength when the snow clears. I know. The Dagda spoke of the king's army. Will you aid us? I will do what I can. But you should know the king's forces are led by the knights of the Gabala, and they will prove deadly enemies.
Claw smiled.
If I put my mind to it, wizard, I think I can be just as deadly. Have a little faith. It's not faith I lack, strong hand. But the knights wear armor protected by spells and carry swords of eldritch power. And even without these gifts, their talents are extraordinary.
Clor put his huge hands on Ruad's shoulders.
Do not tell me of their powers, wizard.
Devote your mind to the problem of defeating them.
It's not going to be quite that simple.
I do not doubt it. But they live and breathe, so they must also be able to die.
Find me a way to kill them.
Chapter 15. Manannan relaxed as the guards took hold of his arms, his head dropping on his chest. Then, in an explosive burst of movement, he tore his right arm free and hammered his elbow back into one guard's throat. The man screamed and staggered. Twisting towards the second guard, Manannan rammed his forehead into the man's face. Free once more, he dragged a dagger from the guard's belt and leapt at Paulus, grabbing him by his long white hair and hauling him forward, so that the knife point rested against the wrinkled flesh of his throat. The four other guards drew weapons, but stood by, uncertain.
"Dismiss them," ordered Manannan, "or your life ends here."
"Get back," squealed Paulus. "Leave us."
The guards helped their injured comrades from the room and pulled the door shut. Manannan dragged back Paulus's head and pricked the skin of his neck, allowing a thin trickle of blood to seep down onto his white tunic.
"You will now take us to my armor and my horse," hissed Manannan, "and then I might let you live."
He flicked a glance at Morrigan.
"Are you coming with me?"
"Where else can I go?"
"Then lead the way through the back of the apartments. The guards are probably there by now, but we'll walk through them."
Dragging the whimpering Paulus, they entered the gardens. The smell from the blooms was almost sickening. The black-cloaked guards had gathered, but they stayed back as Manannan followed Paulus's directions to the stables beyond a high white wall. Kuan was there, standing statue still. Manannan ran his hand over the stallion's back, but the animal did not move.
"What have you done to him?" stormed the once knight. "We made him better than ever he was," said Paulus, "as we were doing with you. Why can you not understand, Manannan? We have given you freely the gift of immortality."
The once knight flung the old man against a wall.
"Immortality? You almost made me one of you, a drinker of souls." "Do not be so romantic," snapped Paulus. "Do you not slaughter animals for meat? Where then is the difference? Or will you tell me that a bull has no soul? It is a living being made up of flesh and blood and bone, and that is all a man is. We perfected the elixir of life. What right have you to judge us?" "I will not debate with you, vampire. There is no point. Now where is the armor?"
Paulus led him to a wide room at the rear of the stable. Here, on wooden trees, were nine suits of silver armor. Manannan's anger soared, and he swallowed hard.
"This is all that remains of the true knights who came here. The proud men who wore these are dead. Just as you are dead, Paulus. You may walk under the sun, but you are dead, a ruined, corrupted thing."
He turned to Morrigan. "Saddle Kuan."
"The guards are gathering outside," she told him.
"Ignore them. Saddle my horse."
"They will not let us leave."
"Then I shall cut a path through them. Now saddle Kuan." "It's not too late for you, Manannan," whispered Paulus. "I spoke harshly before, but you could still join us. Wait and speak to Samuel Danach. He is your friend." "He is dead, Paulus. I do not speak with the dead."
Morrigan led the cold stallion into the room, and Manannan moved to stand before his horse, pulling Paulus with him. He handed his knife to Morrigan.
"If he struggles or moves an inch, kill him. Can you do that?"
"It would be a pleasure," she said,
holding the blade against Paulus's throat. He smiled thinly.
"And how long, my dear, can you survive in the world of blood without your embryo? You will need nourishment, and they will hate you for it. They will destroy you."
Morrigan said nothing. But the once knight saw the truth bring fear to her eyes. He could find no words of comfort and moved to his armor.
"Look out!"
shouted Morrigan, and Manannan swiveled, just as a lance hurtled towards his back. He threw up an arm to strike the missile aside, but the guard who had thrown it stepped from behind a stall and ran at him with sword raised. The once knight reached out and drew his own shining silver blade from its scabbard on the tree.
"You cannot stand against me," he told the guard. "Be sensible and live."
The guard shouted an obscenity and rushed in, whereupon Manannan countered the clumsy blow and slashed a reverse sweep across the man's throat. The guard's head toppled from his shoulders, body slumping to the hay-strewn floor. Swiftly, Manannan donned his armor, buckled the breastplate, and sliding the shoulder guards into place. His stomach heaved and his body shook. Sweat trickled from his face into his eyes.
"Be strong, Manannan," Morrigan pleaded.
He forced a grin and walked to Paulus.
"Now, vampire, you have one last opportunity to cling to your half-life. Open the gate between the worlds."
"I cannot. Not here. The beasts will enter. There must be space for the tunnel."
"Then you die here," said Manannan softly, pressing the sword to Paulus's belly.
"Wait,"
begged the old man.
"I could reach Olifair. He could open the gate."
"Then do it."
Paulus nodded and closed his eyes. A golden circle of light began to grow against the far wall, and Manannan saw a cave, packed with people, and Olifair talking to a tall man with a red-gold beard. He watched as the sorcerer stiffened and turned.
Olifair's voice whispered inside Manannan's mind. "Do not taunt me, Manannan. Begone. Join your brothers."
"I need help, Olifair," said the once knight aloud. "Morrigan is with me. You must open the gate."
"If this is some form of demonic trickery, you will answer for it."
Manannan shook his head.
"Just open the gate, armorer. I'll give you answers."
"Consider it done," said Olifair,
and the vision faded. Manannan rested his sword on Paulus's shoulder.
"Morrigan, I think it best that you also don a suit of armor.
Use the one furthest left. It once belonged to Pateus, and he was slim enough." He watched as she slid from her dress, then turned his attention to Paulus.
"I ought to kill you," he whispered. "By the source, you deserve it. But I will not."
"Do not take a high moral tone with me, Manannan, merely because my ways are different from yours. In your petty world, thousands die in wars and plagues and bloodshed. Their corpses serve no purpose. Here the deaths are relatively few, for we have no battles and no diseases. My people are a cultured race."
"You live on death, Paulus, on other people's misery. Do you drag them screaming for mercy to their deaths? And do they feel fear as you did a few moments ago? Do they beg for their lives as you were prepared to do?"
"I would imagine they do,"
Paulus admitted. "Though the Ambria Vats are in the north of the city, and I have not found it necessary to visit them. But in your world, do not the kings and princes have men put to death? Do they not own slaves whose lives depend upon the whim of their owners?"
"There is nothing either of us can say to reach the other," said Manannan. "You and your race are evil. But then that is just a word to you.
You will be destroyed in time."
Glancing back at Morrigan, who was fastening silver greaves to her calves, he waited until she buckled the sword to her hip, and then patted Cuan's neck.
"Come, great heart, we are going home."
"He does not hear you," said Paulus. "The stallion is dead, but you will find him faster than ever he was. He will not let you down."
"He would not have let me down in life, and that would have been his choice," Manannan told him.
"Go, Paulus, you are free."
The old man turned to find himself facing Morrigan, a sword in her hands.
"What are you doing?"
whispered Paulus.
"He said I was free."
"Perhaps he did."